Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Real Weird Things, folks. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hey, everybody. It's me, your old pal, Justin Robert Young.
Brian Brushwood.
I like the fact that you said the real weird things. No more imposter weird things.
Yeah, we ended up doing after things before weird things, so it became bore four things, and then this is weird things, so there will not be an after things after weird things. But
we will call before things after things, even though before things was before and not after.
Correct. All right. I owe an apology on behalf of weird things.
Okay.
Sharks everywhere after last week's inflammatory podcast, where we pointed out the number of shark attacks in North Carolina was way outside the norm.
Okay.
And I predicted there would be a shark attack. I said I predict a shark attack as we were recording the podcast, but I could have meant while somebody was listening to it too.
And sure.
There was another North Carolina shark attack. But I wanted to get an update because I'm thinking 4th of July weekend. Come on, smorgasbord, all that pale white North Carolina meat out there.
Sure,
exactly. So I
do a little news search to see something here, and I see a headline from the astute news organization NPR, and mea culpa, folks.
Oh, headline. Wow. We got it wrong.
Don't blame the sharks for perfect storm of attacks in North Carolina.
Wait, I'm sorry. The only article I got from you this week was, that's the shark's house.
We'll get to that in a second, Brian.
Okay,
The shark. So, NPR, don't blame the sharks for perfect storm of attacks in North Carolina. So I read this article, and they talk to George Burgess, who is the writer of the book Shark Attack. Awesome book I read in like high school about shark attacks. Amazing thing there, right? And I'm like, great. What is it? Is it barracuda? Is it eel? Is it piranha? What's been doing this? Anyone know what it is?
Chumming.
Well, it's sharks. No, sharks are biting people.
Oh.
But I'm excited. Like, what is biting people? No, it's still sharks biting people. But yeah, I mean, it's not like, no, we get it. It's not like the sharks took a vote, you know, and said, hey, you know what's good? People. So yeah, it's still sharks are biting people. Still, it's a little bit out of normal. There's a lot more people in the water and all that. We haven't heard like a kill all the sharks crusade thing going on. I think that, you know, we're further away from where we were 20 years ago or 30 or 40 when Jaws came out. They're sensational, but we get like, no, sharks are kind of special. And I think the most astute commentary we have there is what I sent you was about the shark house.
Yeah, man. The quote is from WGN TV, Chicago's very own. That's the shark's house. Woman's video about North Carolina shark attack goes viral. Let's take a look. Where's the actual video? Oh,
is
no.
It down below? No?
It was in there. It was in the one I sent you to.
This is the one I got from you. It says, Tennessee, video of a Tennessee woman explaining her summer safety tips, inspired by a recent spate of shark encounters in North Carolina, has been watched nearly 7 million times.
Oh, you want it? Is this an ad block situation?
Oh.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe.
I think somebody
watched it. Somebody's used an ad block and his name's me.
Yeah. Hold on, wait a minute. I got it for you guys.
If you go type in Shark's House on YouTube.
Neshcom says I see it on my screen. I don't know what I missed.
No, he's seeing it on his screen. It definitely is loading. Here we go. Oh, okay. I can get the audio for it.
All right,
it.
That's good enough.
Praise the Lord, everybody. This is the day that the Lord has made. I will rejoice and eat meat in it. Hallelujah. I'm on my way to church this morning, but I wanted to make a quick video because my spirit was troubled this morning. I had the news on. It was talking about somebody else and got ate up by a shark. I want you all to be mindful when you're vacationing. You know, you're going to the beach, do that. Go to the beach. Don't go to the ocean, okay? The ocean is the shark's house, okay? I'm not, and I can swim. I can swim. My whole body is a flotation device. My whole body is a flotation device. I don't have to do nothing to float.
She's a large
But I
woman.
Can't swim. Another thing that makes me suspect and makes me, you know, has my Negro membership card in question, because most black people can't swim, but I can swim. But I'm not going to the ocean because that's the shark's house. Okay. The shark has the right to eat you up when you in his house. When chickens come in my house, guess what? They get ate. When pigs come in my house, they own the plate. So when you go in the shark's house, you're going to get ate up, okay? So I want you to be safe. I want you to be happy. You know, let's use some common sense. If you go into the beach, go to the beach. You watch the ocean from a distance, okay? Please be safe. Safety first. Please, I don't want to hear about nobody from the meat ministry being shark bait.
I mean,
stay out of the woods too. Don't go fooling around with the bears either. The bears will eat you up. That's what they're supposed to do because you're in their house. You know, when animals come in my house, they end up on the plate. They get ate up. So the same thing happens when you go.
All right.
I mean, like, it makes sense when it Panem, in its wisdom, divided us into 12 districts. There's woods, beach, water, Antarctica, downtown LA, Chicago, and Russia.
I'm saying, like, this woman, she's a lovely woman when you listen to the rest of it, and it's very sweet. And she makes a very good point. And it's not this let's kill shark hysteria. It's like, hey, it's the water. That's their place.
That's the shark's house. You know, that is
whose house?
That is fact. Shark's house. You know, sometimes you just like you just make it easy for the Gregory brothers, you know, to make another couple $1 million. You know, whenever it's that impassioned with rhyming lyrics. I don't know whether they have done it yet, but I'm sure they will.
I mean, actually, are the Gregory brothers still on their top of their game on as far as auto tune the news? When's the last time that happened?
Oh yeah, no, they're still rocking and rolling. So hold on, we wanted to apologize because what did we get wrong? Or is the shark
We got nothing wrong.
Good.
I was pointing out a headline that said don't blame the sharks, thinking that there was something else biting people. That was sharks.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's you know, the sharks, they're eating everybody. I mean, you know,
were the porpoises making them do it? You know?
So let's real quick just veer into weird things category here. Yes, we all agree that the sharks should not be killed. Sharks are rad, super awesome. We're all team shark here. Mm-hmm. But is there a species that, like, full on, like, we need to just destroy? Like, if we're going to elect one, like the world and humanity and biodiversity, like, literally the net benefit would be positive if, like, this species Ebola? Was gone and dead forever.
Like Ebola or HIV or...
I mean, we do that, but I'm thinking like a more macro fauna from that perspective. I'm thinking mosquitoes.
I think that, you know,
fire ants,
you know, but let's pick one. Carl says Ebola and HIV aren't organisms. That's a matter of how you define organisms.
Let's go with mosquitoes. Is there a reason? I mean, unfortunately, like, mosquitoes, the very thing that makes them a highly powerful disease vector is that they keep trading blood between person to person. However, I got to imagine that has built up our immunity over billions of years or whatever.
Yeah, but I mean, think of, like, so if you take, let's say, mosquitoes, okay, because fire ants is an easy one to say. No, they aerate soil, they play a function in there. But, and again, you get rid of any one of these things, nature will figure its way out. It'll adapt to it, but it may cause a lot of short-term problems, things like that, to do that. But if you got rid of mosquitoes, I would imagine in many cases that mosquitoes, you know, because they do spread disease, but that also helps regulate certain populations and things like that. I don't know what happens. I know that we've been able to eradicate mosquitoes or certain parts of them, some parts of the world, whatever, and then, you know, it has an effect. And it's you can get rid of anything you want, nature will go forward. It depends on what would be the most beneficial to man. Maybe if we got rid of mosquitoes, but I think there would be repercussions.
Well, and the question is, I mean, like, and apparently there's a post on io9 delving into this very topic that Carl has put into the chat room. But my worry would be it's not that we know exactly how it would be affected should they be taken out of our system immediately, but that we don't know exactly how they fit in. You know, if our biodiversity is, I mean, I don't know. Maybe this just betrays my ignorance to what biodiversity is and how necessary everything is to it. But I guess I envision it to be this bizarre Jenga that removing one whole brick would be devastating.
Well, yeah, I found the Nature, the original article in Nature from about where a person makes the point that we could get rid of mosquitoes and probably be okay.
Probably.
You're going to cause a problem, but that you're going to create a scar, the sort of the niche, but eventually things. And again, it's our problem with mosquitoes has more to do with their ability to spread viruses and, you know, pathogens. That's our problem. They're annoying little bastards too, but we get bothered by that. And that's why, you know, one of the things that the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is trying to do is, you know, they're working towards like mosquito eradication and things like that. Cause we think they're like, well, you know, their place in the ecosystem isn't as, irreplaceable as other things.
Well, and plus also, like, let's say we do eliminate mosquitoes, right? So we have a situation similar to the introduction of penicillin, right? We're about 100 years into the penicillin revolution, and now we're starting to see superbugs develop or whatever. In the meantime, we bought 100 years of increased brain power to solve how to defeat all kinds of viruses and bugs or whatever. Like, let's say today we eliminated all mosquitoes. We buy 100 years worth of brain power for all of the third world, all of the bottom billion, all of a sudden becoming productive, thinking, problem-solving members of society that allows us to defeat. Yes, of course, there'll be a backlash, but we'll be able to take that on because we have 100 years of brain power resources to do so.
Yeah, my curiosity would be, and again, I'm not a scientist, mind you, because I'm trying to think of like what animals do I know that feed off mosquitoes? I know a lot of fish do, you know, I know like trout, a lot of fish. I don't know if it's there. I don't think they're exclusive to that. But I think of like, you know, who eats the mosquito hatches, who does that. My fear is just that how well do we understand the ecosystem in which they function, and particularly in waterborne areas? You know, we tend to, they're pest when they're further out on land. But when you think about, you know, lakes and streams and ponds and areas like that, where you get a lot of mosquitoes, and how their larvae feed fish and other stuff. You know, if we take them out of the system, what do we get that displaces them? Do we get the same problem or whatever? Because the problem with mosquitoes is the pathogens they carry. And will we get something else there too? And, you know, that's why, you know, when it comes to environmentalism, it's why many, many people are, you know, worried about worst case scenarios or things like that, about species loss, is, you know, what happens when you disrupt that.
And all right. So let's talk about this, right? So evolution is not survival of the fittest. Evolution is survival of the good enoughest, right? And that's something that Bonnie was talking about when she was reading the fantastic Daniel Loxton's book about evolution to our kids. Like, knowing that, evolution is an astonishingly dumb computer engine. It's just massively, massively parallel, more parallel than we could really wrap our stupid primate human minds around. So knowing that, The fact that we as humans, which are very, very, very much smarter at solving problems in evolution, all evolution does is try every mutation possible, and the ones that work or slightly benefit tend to live, and that's all they have going for them. Whereas humans, you know, we're able to think things through and mentally project and make all this stuff happen. But now that we have so many humans, seven and a half billion is that what we're up to, we're able to enter the massively parallel game as well. And as we elevate, as we talked about, the, you know, the bottom billion or whatever, to help solving these problems, I mean, maybe is it weird? Is it hypocritic or blasphemous to say that the age of evolution is dead and now the age of human engineered design is beginning? I mean, is that too weird to think of?
I think it's a bit premature.
I said beginning. I said we're certainly not there, but you're telling me in 100 years we're not going to have, you know, the bulk of this under control? 500 years?
I mean, bulk of what under control? I mean,
okay, right now we definitely live in an age where evolution is the biggest dominant force in shaping the genetics of everything, right? I would say within 500 years, which is a blip, it's a nothing in the great timeline of humanity. I think 500 years from now, the majority of evolution will be shaped in some degree by human interests. Like we will release something that will beget something that will beget something that will shape a thing because we know we're going to need it in 500 years.
I think sooner than later we're going to be dealing with our, you know, there are always going to be, you know, complexities out there that as you take a complex system, you start to grasp, and then you pair it with, you take complex system of, you know, DNA genetics, and you take it with a complex system of protein folding, two very complex, and that protein folding is even more complicated than DNA, and then you try to figure out the interactions between the two, and it gets very, very complex. But short answer, yeah, we're already able to do programmable DNA. We're already sort of for a book I'm working on, I've been going in and out of GenBank, pulling out stuff. I did my 23andMe assessment, and then I went and ran through it, this thing that tells you what diseases you're going to have or whatnot, and all that. And it's amazing. We realize, man, this is a much bigger problem than we thought, but computational power is increasing, all these other things. So the short answer is yes. And then we're going to be faced with that situation of what do we want to do? You know, environmentalism right now is sort of has this idea of like, we don't want temperatures to go up, but we know they're going to go down eventually, you know, if we enter an ice age, and should we try to stop that? You know, let's go further out problem. If we start to say, we figured out part of the systems that create that, should we try to stop an ice age from happening?
Yeah, man, I am hesitant to even continue this discussion given like how dicey it is, and politically.
I'm going
to
go yes. Brian, yes, we're going to try and stop an ice age.
We'll skip past the discussion of how fast things are changing right now, what degrees the contributions are happening to it, and what interventions we should be doing. We'll skip past that discussion because that's a complex thing. Check out Matt Ridley's recent article about that. But what I want to say is moving past that, it's 100 years from now, 100 years from now, we got clean tech, we got all that. So that debate's no longer around. We're not worried about that. You know, we're zero emitting, we can say that our contributions, however impactful they are, they're minimal. But now we see this climactic change coming about from a natural cycle where it's going to get colder or whatever. Do we say, Justin says, we stop it. Do we choose Absolutely. Earth optimum?
This is everybody, y'all can hold hands in your Gaia death cult. I'll be over here with the smart, with the eggheads, trying to figure out how to warm this rock up so we can live as long as we possibly can. Because every stitch of advancement that we've had has been the subjugation of nature.
I mean, that's fine. I actually have no problem with the subjugation of nature. Put that on my tombstone. As a matter of fact, there was a fantastic little – I'm trying to find it right now. But there's a Reddit article under the subreddit Data is Beautiful where they showed the trends of how of price per kilowatt hour of nuclear – fossil fuels and solar, and nuclear tended to be clustered around the same area. Fossil fuels went up and down over time, and then you know, meanwhile, you saw this definite downward trend of it becoming cheaper and cheaper, you know, in, again, I have no idea how they wrote that. I'm sure that there was, you know, some kind of factoring in of, you know, incentives and so on. But it's super encouraging to consider the idea that, that we are increasingly getting to a place where we live in an energy abundant world where energy is essentially cheap and free with zero or little to zero environmental impact. And once that happens, you know, the question is like, well, then what? Like, do we just, is there something holy or special or inherently great about evolution that we need to let dumb random chance roll the lottery so we continue to create children with cystic fibrosis or you know, other problems?
Well, I guess that's where you have to look at the specific cases and say, like, I'm all for, you know, doing whatever we can within our DNA to eradicate, you know, the, whatever diseases we can there, and, you know, when early on, and then later on in life, you know, whatever remedies we can do to prolong life, and if we find things that are safe and stable that we can put in, like, you know, right now we're discouraging germline DNA modification because we're unsure if we modify you, we don't want you to we want these modifications to pass on to your children because we're not sure about it. Although the germline, I think it's done. I think those decisions are made out of hysteria. I think that, you know, there are people who are just objecting to it for their own ethical grounds and not be, and their people think like they don't. It is a death cult in a weird way. I'm curious, so like, but like, just back to like, should we stop an ice age?
I mean, who's to say we're not doing that right now? I mean, it's too politically charged.
Our future, Brian.
I'm saying, let's jump forward 100 years, okay? Jump forward 100 years, okay? Whatever we were concerned about, to whatever degree we needed to be or not, or the argument was about where we're going to the climate and where we're doing that, and we imagine we have those technologies to talk about, 100 years from today, okay, 100 years from today, everything's clean, everything's this, we're not using fossil fuels, or not putting CO2 in the atmosphere, we're not doing that, whatever. And now we're like, hey, you know, it's getting colder. What do we do?
I mean, so there's two aspects of this. One, if we're asking the ethical question, there's the secular version of it, which is like, all that exists is us, as far as we know, the only conscious entity in the entire universe, and we owe it to the universe to keep our consciousness alive and preserved and, comfortable in our kind of environment. So it's for us to expand like a virus outside of the petri dish of Earth and go throughout the universe. The other is the religious, ethical, argument, which is that the Abrahamic God has said that the earth was created for man and all of the beasts and the fishes and all of that stuff, in which case I would say that it's a fairly safe interpretation of that, that just as it gives humanity the right to raise and slaughter sheep and cows for consumption, it also gives us the right to alter their, you know, DNA and develop the world to our liking, including making it the right temperature and deciding where to go from there.
So what do you say, Brian?
I mean, I say on the great cosmic timeline, the odds are we are going to live and die and exist as a blink of an eye. And knowing that is by the house odds, our destiny, I say do anything and everything it takes to keep us alive, some piece of us alive for all of eternity. Whether that means that we develop artificially intelligent robot beings that serve as the children of humanity that list for billions of years or live for billions of years going forward, whether that means shaping the climate of our Earth to something that is convenient for us, regardless of how many creatures or species go extinct, whether that means expanding like a virus to every possible chunk of rock or raw material throughout the solar system, galaxy, and multiple galaxies, I say yes, do all of it. Because right now, the one thing I know for sure is that we exist and that we live and that I personally want our mark on this gigantic freaking universe to last as long as possible. And I get asses about anyone else.
We're all on fire for climate engineering. I'll say
yes.
Aye.
Yes. Aye.
Okay, cool. Changing topics now.
Well, just, why do I feel like we're not necessarily changing topics?
We are.
Well, we certainly are, Brian, and it's this kind of diversity of topics that brings us to the weekly reminder that you can support this here show, patreon.com/weirdthings. Again, that is patreon.com/weirdthings. Make sure that you continue to make Weird Things your number one stop for weird, bizarre news, in-depth, deep-dive conversations, and just a little dash of nonsense. Weird Things on Patreon at patreon.com/weirdthings. And thank you to everybody. Beginning of the month, that means your card just got charged. Thank you so, so, so much. And big apologies from Patreon, from us, via us from Patreon, for anybody who had some problems with their cards this month. They had a little bit of a snafu that they are hopefully on top on.
I didn't hear about that. But that's good. I'm glad we got that fixed.
Yeah. We appreciate your support. All right. You know, whenever you get into these discussions about, like, what's going to be future tech or what's going to be possible or whatever, I'm always sort of the mind, like, other than certain things like fast and light travel or whatever, like, you know, don't be quick to say no, or don't be quick to, like, jump on something and say it's not possible. And I also got kind of, was funny, there was an interview about hoverboards, and they asked an astronomer, a famous astronomer, what he thought about it. And I'm like, why are you asking him? What does he possibly know about this other than he's famous, you know, and he's a smart guy, but this is weird. Like I can name some engineers and stuff that give you better answers to that question. So it's always sort of weird of how, scientists, let's ask them. Well, it's not their area of expertise, but we'll ask them anyways. And we've seen stuff come out like, oh, how could you build a lightsaber? You know, and we've heard all the reasons like, no, you couldn't, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Wrong, you could. And we've seen the technology before, and we saw something today this week that's masked as another really, really awesome technology. But I saw this, I'm like, lightsabers? And I've had some people on the weird list were like, yeah, lightsabers. And I think it's only a matter of time. And what it is, it's a really, really awesome application of years ago you asked, like, oh, remember the Star Wars holograms, Princess Leia floating in midair? I remember people like talking, like credible people were like, well, no, you can't project a hologram into midair. You have to have something to reflect off of. That won't work, you know. And then some scientists and engineers are like, well, no, we can actually use lasers to energize air and turn it into a plasma and do this and actually make things float in midair. It's like, well, the energy requirements are this. But it's like, well, no, the answer is yes. The answer is yes. This thing can be done. And now this has taken a big step forward. There are some scientists who are going to be presenting, I think, at the upcoming, I think they're going to be at SIGGRAPH. And basically what they've done is they've taken this technology, use a laser, and you focus it in one part in the air, and it superheats that air, and it turns into a tiny little ball of plasma that glows, right? And you can create little pixels, voxels in midair, and you can create objects. We've seen some of this stuff before. What these people did, which was really cool, is they've actually – this is the University of Tsukuba. They've the Utsu Nagoya Nomiya University and Nagoya Institute of Technology and the University of Tokyo and Sony CSL. I think this is in Canada. that's a joke. So there's the Mashable thing. There's the actual more in detailed article, which is up at Archive. And then the SIGGRAPH paper, or the IEEE paper, gets into more stuff with the press releases and all that. And what this is they're using lasers to project these little tiny dots. They're called femtosecond lasers. So they're able to create super bright voxels of light that you can then touch and feel, because as these lasers ignite these little air molecules and they expand, they create little shock waves that you can touch with your fingers. So it's a hologram you can touch.
A hologram what? You can touch. In the hot ham water?
Man.
It's better to maybe go to the original source article sometimes than Mashable. Just saying.
Dude, Tensor Guy in the chat says, very cool, it will cut your fingers off. I'm just going to say, well, if you got a better way to do it, why don't you have at it, bro?
No, that's the thing. The femtosecond lasers don't do that. That was what the whole point of this was, is the femtosecond lasers use much lower power and they won't cut your fingers off. unless we wanted to.
Uh-huh. So here's what this makes me think of. And this kind of relates to the previous discussion about, like, is it right for humanity to shape the environment and so on?
Well, I just wonder, have you guys seen the video of this thing interacting and moving?
No.
Please.
Okay,
please watch this.
Is it on this Mashable thing, or what should I do?
Neshcom has a video there in the chat room.
All right, let's take a look here. Here we go. Ba-doop-boop, ba-doop-boop.
Fairy lights in femtoseconds. Aerial and volumetric graphics rendered by focused femtosecond laser combined with computational holographic fields. We present a method to render an aerial.
See these
and
little boxes of light glowing. So one's in the shape of a two-dimensional fairy. Here's a heart that a person's touching this heart, and it splits in half into a broken heart. All right. And they look like little glowing dots floating in midair. They have a checkbox. You touch the checkbox, and all of a sudden it's checked.
Wow. That's astonishing. I really
So what I reacted to initially was the first image is just this, like, almost like a loading wheel, kind of. It's one dot just sort of slowly going in a circle. A big old finger comes in, and when the dot comes around, it just, like, reacts as if you had just shocked it. Like, this is amazing.
So what they're calling it, they're saying it's haptic feedback, which is like when you touch your keyboard on your phone and it buzzes or vibrates to tell you that you touched something. It's using lasers and creating plasma in midair to give you haptic feedback, so a touchable hologram. Now, it's not going to be like, huh, I can feel her skin. It's so smooth. I mean, maybe not right now.
Yet. Sure.
Midair holograms were a thing that's like, no, we're not going to be able to do it. Well, now we got midair holograms. Granted, they're like, you know, they're tiny, the size of sugar cubes at best or whatever. But it starts there.
We say they can touch it, right? So, like, it reacts to our touch in a way that you can program. So everything that happens, is another version of it, right? Like, can you feel it? Like, is it?
Yeah, you feel it. It just feels like fire.
It burns. No, it's like it's creating little shock waves of air, little sonic shock waves there. So you touch it, and when you feel it, you feel something, like something interacting with your fingers. That's what makes it really cool. It's not just what you're seeing there with, like, the feedback is probably a camera monitoring to see that you touched it and adjust it. What they're talking about, the thing that makes this special is that when you touch this thing, you don't just feel the burning. It doesn't burn. Is you feel like you're touching an object.
Yeah, it feels like it has some kind of mass to it. Like there's some kind of reaction to your finger. That is insanity. That is crazy. And you're right. It's like, a column of that superheated even more is a literal lightsaber, because what we've always thought is the laser companies that have done their own, like, lightsabers and everything, it's always just like, oh, well, how do you, even if you were to create a laser beam that would be able to slice things, it's, you know, how far does it go, and when does it stop? Like, how do you make it sword length? That is just a dot. It begins and it ends.
Well, okay, so this is I forget the name of the book, and I'm sure Neshcom will have it for us in seconds, but Michio Kaku wrote a book talking about, like, all kinds of various science fiction tropes and how we would make them occur in reality. And one of the things that seemed the most preposterous is stuff like telekinesis, the idea that you would think and that an object would lift and levitate and move or morph or whatever. And he says, well, if you could, you would build a room that was completely under your control. It would have a brain scanner in the room. It would do an fMRI type thing and see what you're thinking out about at any given time. It would analyze the blood flow in your brain. It would analyze that you realize what object you're looking for. It would understand that you wanted to lift that object. And then, using either a series of electromagnets or pneumatic devices or whatever, or pneumatic devices, it would actually raise and lift that object. And you would have, again, it would be an awfully long way to go to create this experience where you felt like you're Professor X moving objects with your minds. But in that moment, you would look at an object, you would think of it, and it would lift and rotate and move and do whatever you wanted.
There are a lot better ways to do a lot of the stuff that he describes in that book. And that's in the, when he even did a TV series on that.
I mean, again, you know, this is a book I read 10 years ago, but yeah. The idea of strip away everything, the answer is yes, by very nature, as time goes forwards and we get smarter, we're going to figure out how to do all these things better. But
well, Michio Kaku, and listen, Michio Kaku is smarter than me than I will ever be. But his niche in pop culture seems to me to be high-end stoner discussion, right? It's just like, hey, man, like, how would you make telekinesis? Well, allow me to explain. And he gives a plausible, I mean, or a way to do it. Like, it is just kind of exploring these ideas, not necessarily the most rigorous or plausible or smart way to do it.
Yeah. But yes, Brian, I think the answer is like, yeah, there are ways to do these things, and many of the things we would have discounted them. And I think that I much prefer a guy like Kaku who's actually out there saying, hey, here's a way to people going, nah, you know, because of this or that. And sort of and again, there are certain things that like we don't that there are things that look like they're really hard engineering problems, and there are things that like violate physics. Time travel violates physics. FDL violates physics. Not to say those things might not be figured out. But
hold on. Let's back up to time travel. For example, like a Michio Kaku like thing would be like, yes, we understand that as it's presented, it would totally do it. But as we see in the Dreaming Void trilogy of from Peter F. Hamilton, he posits a technologically advanced race that is able to create a space at the center of the galaxy that absorbs mass and converts it into energy and uses that energy to create a small medieval-like little planet where ESP does exist. And people are able to travel forward and backward in time. They're able to project back in time. Now, in order to go back in time and correct the mistake you made, then the world needs to be remade. So, of course, you grab the energy from the outside world and does it. I mean, I'm just saying, like it's not.
That version's fine. Every time I play a video game and I say let's reset the world and go back to that's fine. Like I'm okay with that subset universe sort of thing and saying that within that system then we can control and we know all the information and starting states and things like that. And I'm fine. And that was actually a plot device from Galaxy Quest, if we may remember too.
Enough for me. I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
Did you know that Galaxy Quest is on track to be a Netflix TV series?
I hope that happens. That is a perfect little movie. I love that movie.
It's great. It's so good.
Yeah.
And so, like kind of the perfect cast for it.
Oh my God. Yeah.
So, but I mean, I think like if I were to start talking about like if I wanted to write a book on how we could do things like, yeah, like, well, you know, if we're talking about restarting things at an earlier state, are creating an artificial world that feels exactly like, you know, Hill Valley 1955. Yeah, that will get there. But there are other things that are really, really cool that, you know, we've dismissed and, you know, hoverboards or something like that. Like, well, yeah, it's not going to necessarily be anti-gravity. But, you know, if you showed me, you know, when I show people the video of that guy, the Guinness Book Records, setting the thing on his hover, big, huge, you know, drone hoverboard, people ask, is that real? And like, yeah, it's real. And, you know, when you start getting into things like transmitting power and you start getting into using like electro aerodynamic propulsion and stuff where you have things with no moving parts, but air currents move all around it and you have access to more power, you'll get stuff like that. You'll get flying cars. You'll get hoverboards.
Here's the problem that we encounter is that we get closer and closer. Like as we've entered a world where it is more likely than not, when you see somebody on a board that is floating, it is, let's say in the universe just of YouTube, right? It is more likely to be a simulation than somebody actually suspended in the air, whether it be on a, like electromagnetic device, like there was the copper half pipe that had this thing that Tony Hawk was on. But however, Tony Hawk also was in a full-on fraud simulation of a fake hoverboard thing.
Yeah.
Right? Right? And so it's like you have one example that's real, one example that's fake. I would say that in general, it's easier to simulate floating around, riding on a surfboard that floats, than to not do it. And as we get farther and farther and the technology to simulate gets better and better and better, it really lends credence to the utterly creepy, horrific idea that, of all people, Stephen Hawking has said, which is, all things being equal, seems like all of reality would be a simulation rather than reality, because it's obviously way easier to simulate things than to actually do them.
Yeah, I've been, that was back in the, back when Justin was high school and I used to go do my after school class, the Monkey Man class. That was one of the things we talked about was, you know, if you could create, you know, if you can create a simulation and you can create a super realistic simulation, what are the odds that we're living in a simulation? And it becomes close to 100%, you know, and that's not a novel idea. I mean, other people had it, didn't write about it till later on, but I digress. But the point is that, you know, I think it's, and I think that's going to be, you know, some of the most exciting area of physics is going to be in computational physics, is going to be into the, just these things of computational simulations and stuff, and going into, well, how many sets of rules do we have to create in order to define a universe? And then do these start to match up with the way our universe works?
So let me, can we dip our toes just ever so quickly into theological ground? The discussion among atheists versus agnostics versus believers of all faiths tends to be what the null hypothesis should be. And atheists believe that the null hypothesis should be that everything is exactly the way it looks, and that it...
That's, know. Again, you use a definition that does not apply to me.
Well, okay, that's what I wanted to ask you guys, because it seems to me like, to me, is there a reason that the null hypothesis can't be that we're all just brains in a vat, or that we're all just pieces of bits in a computer? Like, is that any less likely than anything else?
Well, I mean, that was when I would get into my, you know, my high school sort of philosophical discussions about, like, well, what do you believe? I'm like, well, I mean, you know, I use, because, you know, the defining atheism gets to be very problematic, because it's a word that gets it, you. Definitions are usage, and how people usage define words. And if people use words differently, you're not going to find an agreement on that. Traditionally, historically, atheist was anybody who did not believe in your religion was an atheist, because they didn't believe in your God. They believed in a false God, ergo no God.
Right.
And that's where that came from. Could we all be brains? Yeah, of course. I mean, that was a thing. And I always say that, like, yeah, there's not a religion that I, one, proactively say, yes, I believe in. If you said, could we be brains in vats? I'd say that is more likely to be true to me if I think that reality is consistent than these other versions of it. Do I think that to be true? No. But do I think it to be false? No.
I mean, I guess this comes, and, you know, full disclosure, this comes from a place in me where it's like, there's a lot of, agnostics seem to be the bisexuals of the religious philosophy world, where it's like, they're not accepted by either camp, and they aggressively is like, pick a side, jerk. But it's like, to me, like, you can't prove I'm not a brain in a vat. And until you can prove either side of that, then I'm going to remain comfortably agnostic.
Yeah, but remember that the problem, agnostic breaks down when you say, you know, define, like, you know, things you cannot define, you know, the existence of God. But that assumes that there is a specific definition of God. Do I believe in Xenu? You know? No, I don't think it's rational to believe in Xenu. So I'm not really agnostic on Xenu.
Okay, so what would the proper label be? If what I wanted to say is the only thing I know for sure, the only thing that all of religious debate and philosophy, the greatest philosophers and thinkers and logicians in all of humanity, the one thing that we know for absolute certain is that we don't know.
Well, I mean, that would be an agnostic. I mean, that would be an agnostic. But again, you can be atheistic on other positions, though. That's the problem, is that it breaks down, because if you say, are you agnostic on Xenu?
But here's the funny part, is even on Xenu, I would like to think I have a scientific position of, I think it is highly unlikely that that is the case.
Okay, and that's different than saying that it's unknowable.
Correct. I would say it's astonishing, because, again, let's think about it this way. If you believe deep enough in string theory and so on, then you believe that all possible universes exist, and in one of them, Xenu might exist, and it might even be ours, you know, or a variation of ours or whatever. So it's like, if that's the case, then it seems like the only scientific position is to say that is highly unlikely, and I'm not going to operate my life as if Xenu exists.
Yeah.
But I won't say he doesn't.
And so atheist is often going to be a term that you can refer to as how do you feel about a particular position? Well, I could be agnostic towards that or an atheist towards that, you know.
Man, I guess I I'm a flawed individual, but it's like I guess I'm really, really comfortable being agnostic on everything. That's
fine. I think that the thing that's happened to when you talk about usage is that it's become very I know a lot of people who are deists, and not saying you, but I know a lot of people who are using deist to describe, you know, they use agnosticism to describe their deism.
You know, I don't know for sure. There's a chance that could be the case for me. I don't suspect it is, because I am equally comfortable with the idea that we exist as a cosmic accident of two multidimensional brains banging into each other, creating a burst of energy, and we are one of a billion different universes. And I'm also equally comfortable thinking that we are the artificial construct of an external intelligence running a simulation.
Yeah. And that's right. We've had people point out there that we have atheism and agnosticism, and that, you know, that theological positions assume too much about these things. But again, if you get into the historical example, then I can still, if I were a Catholic in the year 1600, then I would say, well, you're still an atheist.
Yeah, because it's outside of this. I mean, Justin, I would love to hear you chime in kind of on, because I assume you've thought about all this stuff.
I mean, not really. I mean, like, I guess it's just, I find these conversations to be a little just recursive by nature, because ultimately it's what Andrew's saying, that like, we're not playing with the same tools. Like, what I assume to be atheist, what I assume to be God, what I assume to be proof, what I assume to be the philosophy of it is interpreted and known with so many different variations that, oftentimes even making the guess that we are all working from the same base assumptions is the worst possible thing. Because now you're using words that mean something to other people, and on something as deep and ingrained as life, death, eternal, you know, life everlasting, whether or not I'll see my grandpa again, you know, like you're playing around with like these kinds of ideas and things that people have made life choices on, where it's just, I don't know. It's just always kind of playing with nitroglycerin, in my opinion, whenever you talk about it. In terms of my own thought, like, yeah, I don't know, man. Like, what Brian's saying, yeah, seems legit. Like, you know, the idea that there's no God. Yeah, I mean, that seems okay. Like, there's a million other, like, different things that I could focus on that I don't really think about it all that much.
Part of my frustration gets into the usage and the implications thereof. And that, on one hand, is when I was younger, I was frustrated with friends who were deists who call themselves agnostics, you know, because I'm like, no, that's not, you're like, well, I think there's something, but we can't. I'm like, well, no, that's not what it means. On the other side of it, like, I identify as atheist, but like, I like Christmas displays. You know, when I hear about some group that wants to ban this stuff, I think they're acting like jerks, you know, and I think they're doing a weird interpretation of a constitution I've read too, in that they're being unduly critical of one area of belief when they wouldn't be that of others. And I think that everybody should have the right to practice as they want. And I think that, you know, when there's things that are ceremonial or things that come down to it that are just cultural, you know, I have no issue with that. I have no Christmas tree. I like that. I have no problem with that. You know, with some stuff that says things on our money, fine. I don't care.
That's fine. It's a rich cultural tapestry. Here's the funny part. Like, before CJ Johnson is the reason that I am a magician today, is because I got to tour with him and watch him do his illusion show at hundreds of shows. That's how I met and fell in love with Bonnie. And there are rituals to this very day. I will never, ever be backstage with CJ Johnson before a show. And I apologize, Neshcom, you're going to have to bleep this out, in which we don't lean forward and say, it's time to pray. And we put our dukes in, like as all of our fists in, and then we start going one potato, two potato, three potato, four. And then we recite some lines from a George Carlin routine where we start going, rat, bash, dirty old, 69 ass, tied in a knot, Ray, lizard, shit, fuck, woo. And then we give double middle fingers, and then we walk out and have a great show. It is a quasi-religious experience that I wouldn't trade it for the world, and it's utterly secular and has nothing to do with anything that came before it, but I feel like we're better people for having done that every time. I don't know. It puts us in the right headspace.
Yeah, I think that there is, you know, we saw a horrific church shooting, you know, recently, the horrific event that took place, and the community stood together, and the community embraced this idea of compassion that is, you know, a big part of their religion, and we saw the best part of that. And I was very impressed by that. And I could be, you know, we had a demented evil person do a horrific act, and we saw people around there who just rose up above it to not try to make this into a hate thing and not try to do everybody else around outside of there, you know, just went ape nuts, whatever, like this. And I was, and there is one, you know, people go, we can get into saying, well, all the bad in the world happens because of religion. No, all the bad world happens in the world because of bad. You know, we'll use whatever definition. Religion is often a very, very convenient way to do that. But most of the deaths that were involved in, you know, in the hunt, in that weren't, you know, one person killing another on a level, you know, individual level in the 20th century were done by secular governments, you know, was the communists, these other people who are supposed to be non-religious.
Dude, man, in the contest of who did the most evil, Stalin beat Hitler, and yep. Stalin was on team atheist, and Hitler was on team Christian.
And you, if you want to go look for a mass murderer of the 20th century who was doing this on purely religious grounds, okay, that like you could clearly find the religion, the closest one you're going to find, like, you know, the Nazis did it on this idea of this weird socialist ideal of racial purity or whatever. And they had this sort of weird sort of pseudo-religion that the inner people, you know, did, but it was more just hatred of the other group. The closest you're going to get is Pol Pot, who was a Buddhist.
Sure.
And that's not – nobody likes to talk – like I've heard something like, oh, the Buddhists, they never bothered anybody. Cambodia much, you know? And so, I mean, that's it's just this weird sort of thing we get into where, like, you know, people with bad ideas do bad things. People with good ideas do good things. And
and I guess that's the thing, right, is that people do good things in the name of mm-hmm. many different religions, and people do bad things in the name of many different religions.
So, like, you know, you draw a Mohammed cartoon, there's a small faction of people there who are going to be very upset by that and send you death threats and maybe shoot up your event. You make a play, the Church of Mormon, the Mormons take out a full page ad in Playbill saying, hey, enjoy the play, but by the way, check out the real Book of Mormon.
Yeah, man.
They, by the way, in the San Francisco production of Book of Mormon, they bought out every advertisement in the Playbill. Every advertisement was bought by the Mormon Church, and it was stuff like the play, read the book. Like, it was all cheeky.
Which is so, it's so Mormon. Like, what is it with Mormons that they're all so nice and wonderful and pleasant to be around, and I just love hanging out with them and having discussions.
But part of it is not only, I mean, like, you can't separate how people understand it from the discussion itself. And it's like, so why do we say religion causes murder and death? Because, you know, our pattern recognizing brains want a way to quantify why these evil things happen. And we want to find the reason. We want to plug it in when the math is too complex, and yet we need an answer. And that's very often, in my opinion, why we get these like super oversimplified elements that usually happen to match exactly with our own opinions. How crazy is that?
And listen,
Dan Wally says is ignorance is bliss. I don't think it's ignorance. I mean, like, it's literally the definition of curiosity, like that we try to do it. It is when we can't, when we do our curiosity disservice is when we say, okay, well, we found the evidence. Like, let's move on. Let's stop thinking about that and start thinking about something else. It's just, you know, I think just always keeping an open mind on this kind of stuff and keeping your eye open to what's happening.
There are I don't know. There's probably been 6 or 7 different cycles throughout my life, usually separated by 4 to 8 years apart at a time, where I have stumbled across really trying to grok the strange and unbelievable nature of the fact that we exist and that the universe exists, and try to wrap my mind around the idea of going from nothing to something, even if it's just a brief explosion, even if all of the universe is a mayfly that exists for a single day before it either collapses into the heat death of the universe or, you know, into a big crunch that bursts again. And there are moments as if I'm on the world's highest diving board that I just am struck with a lightning bolt of terror. And maybe part of the reason that I've guided the discussion this way, even what small parts I have, has been like, in the last couple of weeks, I had another one of those thunderbolts, and it started with just the theoretical construct, like, you know, are we a simulation? Could it be? You know, and how, like, if your question is how did the universe exist, you know, saying God made it doesn't solve it, because then it just, you know, opens up the next question of like, oh, well, then what made God? And is God, like, you know, a government worker in some bigger version of the universe? And where is Ant Farm or whatever? I don't know. In other words, I guess I'm apologizing. I'm saying sorry if I drew this into heavy territory, but it definitely weighed heavy on my mind the last couple of months or weeks.
And, you know, it's totally inappropriate for this conversation, too.
The show's called Rational Things, Brian. Yeah, when will you realize this?
I became, you know, it was in the 90s, and I became very fixated on the idea of, it was after reading, like, K.R. Drexler's book, Engines of Creation, which came out like 1991. I read that on a cruise ship like a year after. And then I became very fixated on reading about art. You know, it was really pre-internet boom. Started reading about artificial reality and stuff, and read an article about the Nintendo 64 came out. Because it was just, I became, the fact that it had a Cray computer inside of there, essentially, that was originally Cray computers. So that was Nintendo 64 was 96, yeah, right?
Mid-90s. To put it in perspective, Jurassic Park posited that somebody had a project so big that they needed 3 Cray computers in 1992 in order to design it.
Yeah, and so when they eventually shrunk that chip down, and that fit into the Nintendo 64 effectively. And I remember thinking about that going, man, like watching Mario run around and jump and do all this crazy stuff. I'm like, this is a form of reality in there. This is a form of reality in there that we're going to get to the point we're going to be able to eventually, it'll look like a dude, and the dude will walk around and interact. And I became so aware of all of the ways, you know, you leave your keys in the refrigerator, you forget things. I'm like, man, like our own programming is so limited. And, you know, that it just, to me, like, yeah, I became fixated on that idea. And I went through this sort of like, are we real? I mean, what is real? Are we a simulation? Are we in?
I had to a lesser degree that exact experience just during the family reunion over the last week. 9 times out of 10, when I walked into the living room, they were playing on the PlayStation 3. It was the last generation PlayStation device. They were playing FIFA, playing soccer or whatever. And it just so happened that the World Cup of Soccer for Women was happening. And one of those times I walked in and they were watching it. And it was a good like 5 to 7 minutes before I was like, wait, who has a control? You know, wait, is nobody playing? Like, who's controlling whom? And then I realized, oh, wait, I'm watching actual reality and didn't even recognize it in that moment. And then poor chick scored on her own goal and it felt really bad for her.
Oh.
I have had that experience too now. You'll get a little bit of a video or a little bit of this and you go, I saw Terminator Genesis and the Arnold in that, the young Arnold in that, granted, he's playing a cyborg who doesn't emote. You know, when they showed him the Arnold from, you know, 1984 was really good. It was way better than, you know, what we'd seen in prior ones. And I'm like, this is close enough. And I've seen some demonstrations of like amazing facial capture, and then I've seen simulations of people talking and stuff now that totally passed the test that you would not know that you were watching a person that was really created.
To segue into pics, man. That was one of my favorite parts of Ex Machina, when our mad scientist says, yeah, we're going to do a Turing test. Also, it's definitely a robot. Let's just get past that, because she would fool the pants off of you, whether it's on the phone or, you know, if I dressed her up or whatever, you would believe it's a human.
Yeah.
Shall we?
Which is a weird Turing test.
Well, I mean, it's she clearly passes the Turing test, but the advanced philosophical question of the Turing test is what he appeared to be, you know.
I wish we could discuss this movie, Brian.
Okay, we'll hold off. We'll hold off. Actually, because my pick. Can we jump into picks?
Let's jump in, guys. Let's do picks.
My pick is something I watched over the last couple of nights. I watched half of it last night. I watched the rest of it this morning. And I know that everybody here has secret inside sauce that will inevitably color our stuff. But without speaking out of turn, I would love it if we could talk about what you guys thought, because I assume you guys have seen it, because my pick is on Netflix. You can now watch the James Randi documentary, An Honest Liar. And I'm really conflicted about it, because I loved the first half of it. I thought it was a really good story of the important work that James the Amazing Randi has done as far as exposing liars and fakers and pseudoscientists and starting the modern cause of rationalism, you know, of rational thought. I really wish it hadn't got diverted into what some might consider salacious, sensational territory. But I also understand why the director would want to do that, to create a balanced story. But I wonder if it's a false dichotomy, if it's a false balance, if it's a false, like, hey, people lie on both sides of things. Crazy, right? Wait, did you guys see it?
I haven't seen the movie. Having personally known the principles, I don't know what's in there and what's not. I'll follow Andrew's lead.
I haven't seen the movie.
Okay. Well, then, yeah. Okay. Then that's fine.
I know. And I mean, I know.
I can't even. Okay. That's fine. I don't want to lead you guys into uncomfortable territory. But to set the context, I am somebody who has been a fan and very influenced by James Randi's work. I loved it. A number of characters give it a lot of different comments, some of which you could tell were done out of context. But the first two thirds of the movie appear to be about all the astonishingly nowhere during the entire movie does the $1 million challenge get mentioned, which is a bit astonishing to me, as it may be Randy's biggest legacy to all of humanity, and that he put your money where your mouth is proposition that caused, you know, us to elevate the discussion about what is and is not paranormal. However,
you want to know what's funny? I think Brian, you actually put it in the right context for me about, like, why is the $1 million challenge important, for which, you know, for fairness purposes, it behooves us to mention that Andrew was the official on for many years. And it's because it is the cocktail party conversation ender, right? Like, it is so important as a, well, hey, listen, I'm not saying it's real or not. I'm saying there's $1 million on the table. So, like, I think your friend probably does have psychic powers. And I'm really excited to come to his pool party at his new house that he buys with the $1 million that he gets. Like, it's just a way, in a world of conflict, in a world of this needs to be changed, you're a fraud, it is the ultimate way in which culturally we can wrap our mind around, hey, no, yeah, we can all agree that it's effed up, this guy's lying, right? So he should probably get that money.
Yeah. So let me just say this, is that there's sort of what I perceive to be a bit of a false equality, because among the commenters you have you have Yuri Geller, who is. It is unfortunate to me, man. I have really complicated feelings about this movie, and I would like to hear other people chime in. I'm not going to assign it to you guys because I feel like that would complicate things unnecessarily for you. But in at the end of the day, it ends with this false equality between James Randi and Yuri Geller, and I feel like that's totally unfair.
Yeah.
For reasons that I don't want to give away, here's what I'll say.
I haven't seen the movie. Your description is frustrating to listen to, and I suspect that maybe I would be frustrated for the same reasons. I think. It's really all right, like,
this is my pick. Everybody go to Netflix right now, watch An Honest Liar, and let me know what you think. And I would be extremely interested to hear from people who have no idea who James Randi is or who Yuri Geller is, and to tell me what you think of this movie and what you think of the principles as they're portrayed in it.
Known the principles for 25 years.
So you're disqualified, Andrew. I don't want your opinion. I want everyone else's.
I will say this. James Randi is a international treasure. He is an amazing person. And when I got the chance to do a podcast with him very early on, in my podcasting career, and I almost wished that I was better at my job at the point where that opportunity kind of presented itself, but Andrew had the idea to put it together. He just to sit next to that guy and listen to just stories, like, you know, just it's insane the impact that he has had, and just the rooms he was in and where he casually stories of Isaac Asimov and
that's what I wanted to ask. Can you real quick just share that one little tidbit of the Isaac Asimov story as you told it to me?
Well, he's got there's a couple, and I think the podcasts are still up there if anybody wants to listen to them, so you can hear Randi tell them, and he's much better at telling the stories. But he would mention about Isaac Asimov that he'd call him, and he would just hear in the background this, like, what he described as almost like a ticker tape, like just tapping, and he's having a conversation, and just a regular as we are having a conversation that's back and forth. He doesn't seem distracted, and he's like Isaac, what does that sound like? What are you near? You like near machinery? Because again, this is decades ago. It's like there's only so many things that make that kind of sound. He's like, oh no, I'm typing. He'd be typing a story while on the phone, and had the brain power to go and make it seem like it was a real conversation. Now, knowing Randi and the kind of orator he is, I assume that it might not have been as difficult as one might have thought, considering how much Randi talks. But it was. It is still amazing, you know.
I learned so much of the way I think about things was affected by Randi. Randi is one of the people. Randi is the greatest science teacher I ever had. Randi is the greatest teacher I ever had for experimental process and all of these things. I am very, very, very indebted to him for all that.
Yes. Well, if you get the chance, I'd love to chat with you guys if and when you get around to seeing it. But what's your pick, gentlemen?
I'll tell you what. I have my pick next. I don't know how much I'll ever really be able to publicly talk about that movie. Like, it's just there's so much. There's so much there. There's so much history, and you know, it's okay. Because also, I mean, like the issue that they go into is so personal to you know the principles there. You know, that takes the second path to it. So I don't want to leave this as a cliffhanger that next
okay,
week.
That's fine. That's fine. That's totally fine. However, I will say, man, is it ever weird to watch a movie where there are more people on screen that you know personally than not? Like, I mean, it's like, you know, like, wait, this is a movie or like a whole movie? What's happening? Because I know all these people.
Yeah. Well, here, I got a pick, comes out this Tuesday. It is a book by the name of the devil. It is by Andrew Main. who is not, that is not the name of the devil. That is the name of the author.
Well, hold on. No spoilers. All right. Let's not get ahead of ourselves.
Take away the name of the devil is not Andrew Maine. it is indeed the sequel to Angel Killer, Jessica Blackwood novel. This is a book that, man, I can't remember when I first got the chance to read this, but it is exceptional. The praise is already pouring in for it. And it comes out this week. Everybody needs to go ahead and check it out. This is a real good old-fashioned a book that is being published by Bourbon Street Books. It is also just exceptional. It really is well done. If you enjoyed Angel Killer, then you're really going to like it. But I would also say, you know, if you didn't listen or you didn't read Angel Killer, I think that this book does a fair job of standing up by itself, and it'll make you want to read back Angel Killer as a prequel, you know?
Try to make it standalone.
Yeah, you know, it is really, really well done. And I'll tell you what, you go ahead and take the Justin Robert Young challenge. If you can read the first 30 pages of this book and just put it down, then it just ain't for you. Then you just don't like that kind of story, because the first 30 pages, like, this book begins with a bang, very literally and very gruesomely in a way that I think will capture your imagination, especially as it results to these kinds of topics like religion and magic and science and trying to believe and understand what, really the theme of these books, the theme of the Jessica Blackwood novels, beyond so much of the engrossing narrative and characters, is the idea of hitting your head on a logical ceiling and figuring out how to get around it in really the grand tradition of mystery writing, except it makes the stories create that ceiling out of so many amazing taboo subjects like religion and magic and like what is possible and the idea of turning the idea of the impossible against us, and how much we can allow the evil we can allow to be created within it is exceptional. So go ahead and pick it up. It is out in paperback this Tuesday. Name of the Devil by our co-host and your friend, Andrew Maine.
Oh, yeah. Riddle me this, Justin. What kind of listener to the Weird Things podcast would be interested in religion, magic, and science? Name one.
All of them.
Oh, yes.
Every single. If you listen to this podcast, man, you are going to really enjoy Name of the Devil. Hell, I would tell you to go ahead and get both of them if you ain't listened, if you ain't read Angel Killer. Get Angel Killer and Name of the Devil. Get them both in paperback. Sit down, have yourself one hell of a day.
We were talking about in the pre-show that Bonnie full-on stole my copy. Like, your publisher, Andrew, sent it over, and then the moment arrived, Bonnie, who normally does not get a little fangirly over some stuff. And understand, this is the same Bonnie who, upon hearing that it was her friend Andrew Maine writing as in the first person as a female, she's like, oh my God, Andrew Maine, as if he could write as a girl. And then now here she is. She's like, oh, I got to get this next book. I'm totally into it. I got to read The Adventures of Jessica Blackwood.
Here's how I write as a woman. I just assume I know nothing about them, and I'm not going to tell women about the female experience. I write a character who happens to be a woman. And, has...
Well, no. But it is important. For example, in the first book, I really dug the way you were able to speak directly about the... I don't want to say inherent misogyny of the magic world to women, but there's some unfairness. I personally find it unfortunate that, when we list the 30 greatest magicians in history... the odds are unfortunately skewed in favor of males over females. And I really like that you made a strong female protagonist of that world who deals with the realities of that world. When you talk about the quasi-embarrassing cover, image from the magic magazines back in the day that she had and so on, that really struck home with me. I dug that.
My point of view was like, let me go in there and sort of think like, what are all the things I didn't get or didn't understand? Like how how have they been a part? I didn't want to come from like, well, as a feminist, let me tell you, ladies, what you're experiencing. No, that's a trap.
Yeah, there's no agenda for anyone worried about it. It's very, very clear.
And
there's
But I see male writers fall into that, like, right, ladies, right? I'm like, I don't know. I don't understand. I don't know. I know there's a lot to deal with in that, and this is me trying to take it apart and analyze it and look at it and stuff, but it's you know, and but again, it's not about like it's not Bridget Jones' Diary or anything like that, you know. And I just try to touch on what are all the human insecurities or things we have to deal with or things like that that we can all relate to. And I mean, the highest form of praise I got was, you know, my editor HarperCollins, Hannah Wood. She got it. She thought I was written by a woman. She thought it was, you know,
a pseudonym.
Some lady, you know, pseudonym. When I'm like, ah, it's a compliment, you know, and freaked Justin out a little bit.
That's awesome.
thank you very much. I have a pick. I'm going to pick I'm almost way through it. I went back to go watch this again, and it's The Mummy.
Oh, the Brendan Fraser franchise.
Man. Mummy rules. The Mummy rule.
There was a fantastic article talking about, like, I want to say what happened to Brendan Fraser or something like that was the title of it. But it was great. It made me sad for the death of the traditional Hollywood, you know, star-making machine.
Well, I mean, Pratt seems to be doing pretty good.
Fair enough.
You know, and I think that as a movie, I think it's Stephen Sommers' best movie. You know, it's just you look at what happens in that first 20 minutes, and there's just so many things and the characters that are laid out for you. You know, it's just a delightful movie. And so I thought, you know, I had fun with the second one to a degree. It's had flaws, and the third one just went, you know, like, well, okay. But, you know, they're rebooting that whole franchise, so.
Well, good.
And they should. Yeah, I guess I'm looking at Stephen Sommers.
The article that I'm thinking of is Tribeca Film. If you just search for Brendan Fraser, the movie star that Hollywood forgot, and it talks about, you know, what an amazing career he had and how unfortunate it is. It says unfortunate, like it's obvious that the goal needs to be for everyone to remain on top at all times. But meanwhile, he's apparently very busy doing very awesome, you know, interesting independent film roles.
Yeah, you have... You know, you have, and that's something too, is like sometimes you get actresses who go in there, they do some great roles, and they're like, okay, you know, they're interested in doing it from 22 to 32, and then facing the fact there's not as many opportunities or great roles out there for women past a certain point, and they're kind of like, all right, I'm going to go do other stuff, and I got the affirmation that I needed from this, and I showed my skill and do that, and you know, some actors, you know, they do it. And then it's like, well, do I need to chase the next big role for somebody, or do I just find things that are going to be interesting to do?
Right.
And sometimes there's only so much room, so many opportunities and stuff.
But also it's like, you know, man, you look at a movie like The Mummy and kind of compare it to, like, you know, two movies that have come out this summer where, you know, you had Mad Max and Jurassic World, and in two different, very, very different movies and in very, very different ways, we're kind of unapologetic about, hey, this is a big, fat thrill ride. Like, we're going to put you in these situations where you, like, are invested in the characters, and it is, like, big, fun action filmmaking. And The Mummy, you know, in that year of 1999, which is, you know... kind of has been glorified as a great year of filmmaking, you know, was just that. I mean, that is, I mean, you talk about just a perfect summer movie. It is, you know, The Mummy is just there.
Yeah. Cool.
Right on.
Gentlemen, it's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.